to you across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio. And Kerry Deese, Ninja Processor, fending off those evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour as we look at the ins and outs of mortgage financing. Kerry, we're going to cover a couple of topics today, and each of those might could be a show in and of its own, so we're going to kind of do some introductory information.
And before we do that, just a reminder, you can always email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. Or if you need to catch up on a past show, you can go to our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com. You can listen to them all there, and you can also find a whole host of articles about mortgage-related topics that you might be interested in.
That's great. And then always feel free to call us. Our telephone number is 864-235-9596. Call us anytime. We're going to talk this morning, first of all, about qualifying income, which brings me to the question of the day. Does qualifying income mean, A, the income you qualify for when applying for Social Security, or B, the income you should qualify for on your new job, but they won't pay you that much, or C, your income after the government has taken 50% of it away in taxes and squandered it on some stupid study, or D, the income the lender uses to see if you can afford your house? The answer, as always, at the end of the program. So strap on your jetpack and join us for a fast-moving hour of mortgage fun. Qualifying income. Kerry, we talked last week about credit as important, but I think I would say that qualifying income may be equally or as important.
Yeah, it's right up there.
Process, yeah. So qualifying income. That's the amount of income that a lender can use to determine whether you can make your house payment for the next 30 years and whether you can service all your debt payments for that long. So it's critical in the underwriting process. And it might sound like something that's fairly straightforward, but we find that it's actually a good bit of confusion about it. First of all, there are different underwriting guidelines for statutory employees. Now, you're a statutory employee if you receive a paycheck with deductions on a weekly, monthly basis, where you're issued a W-2 at the end of the tax year. There's a difference in being a statutory employee and being a self-employed borrower or an independent contractor, where you are compensated by 1099 as an independent contractor and you file your own tax returns, or if you own a company in some manner. So let's take first the statutory employee. Kerry, what is the beginning basis for determining the qualifying income of a statutory employee?
We look at your base pay, and that could be either hourly pay. If you're paid by salary, that would be your annual pay, or whatever you're paid, the gross, biweekly or monthly.
And all lenders distill out your pay structure to a monthly income. And the key for a statutory employee is that your qualifying income is your gross income. It's not your take-home pay. And quite often when we have potential borrowers fill out an application, they'll actually put their take-home pay as their income. But that is not what you get credit for. You actually get credit for the gross amount. The reason the lenders allow you to be credited with your gross income is they've already calculated into your debt ratio figures how much money is coming out for Social Security, how much is being withheld for income tax purposes, and so they credit you with your gross base income. Beyond base income, there can be any and a wide range of what we call irregular income. Kerry, what are some of the things that qualify as irregular income?
Overtime, bonuses, shift differential. We see that a lot in people in the healthcare fields, stuff like that.
Yes, and even commission. And there are times where a statutory employee's pay may be structured with both a base income and with irregular income. So irregular income is treated differently from the base. Effectively, we're going to talk about this throughout this section on qualifying income. There is a two-year rule that applies pretty well across the board to any income that is not regular gross base pay. And the two-year rule says that in order to count any of your irregular income, whether that's overtime, bonus commission, shift differentials, anything like that, you have to have been on your current job for 2 years, and then you have to separate out that irregular income and average that income for 2 years. So many times we'll have a borrower come in and we ask him what his pay is, and he says, well, you know, right now I'm making $48,000 a year. But we find out, well, that's a $24,000 base, and last month he made a commission that if you extrapolated it for a year, it would have been another $24,000, but he's not going to get another commission for another 6 months, and it's not going to average out to that. So a good bit of confusion as to how these things can be counted. Your base income, 100% of it can be counted, your gross amount, but all of your overtime, bonus, shift differentials, you have to be on your current job for at least 2 years, and we have to average that income.
And in addition to that, we have to show that it will be likely to continue for 3 years.
That's right. And that's all of the tests for income in underwriting involves the test of past receipt and anticipated continuity. And we'll get into some of the shades of that. But the past receipt is just the presence of paychecks, stubs that we get to verify you're on the job, as well as W-2s to show that you've been there. The expected continuity has to come from the employer stating that it is anticipated that this borrower will continue to receive the overtime, the bonus, the commissions, and the shift differentials that they've been getting.
And the way we do that is I will send a request to your employer. It's called a verification of employment form, and they will have to write out all of your income information, again, even though it is right there on the pay stubs. And there will be a couple of boxes to check to see if those sources of income are likely to continue. And as long as it says yes, we're good on that front.
We do have an occasion where, because of production needs, an employer has initiated overtime that they do not anticipate will continue. And what happens, Carrie, when they check the no box?
Unfortunately, we can't use that income for qualifying purposes.
So the employer themselves have to state whether they expect the borrower to continue to earn overtime. They don't have to state an amount that they expect them to continue to make, but they do have to state that the continuity, the expected continuity. So remember the two-year rule. It's going to show up in a number of different places. We can always help you calculate your qualifying income from your paychecks, your W-2s, and from a discussion with the HR department of your employer, but you may want to have that information in hand if and when you are ready to apply for a loan. You can get the information and the breakdown of your past receipt from your HR department at the company you work for. So, Carrie, we've got a couple of other situations with statutory employees. One of those is part-time income or part-time job. And the other is, in the restaurant business, the receipt of tips. So let's talk first about part-time jobs. What applies in terms of when you can count income from a part-time job?
Well, we're right back to that two-year rule. Although there are some exceptions if your part-time hours are guaranteed, and in that case, you have to have been on the job for a year. But again, your employer has to be willing to state that those hours are guaranteed and likely to continue.
And in regard to tips, we can only, unfortunately, count tips that are reported on your W-2 for the last 2 years from your employer. Again, the two-year rule comes into play. When we get back, we're going to cover 1099, independent contractors, and self-employed borrowers and their qualifying income. We're back. We've been talking about qualifying income in a mortgage process, how do they count the income that they give you credit for? And having talked about statutory employees, those are employees that receive their pay by W-2 wages, and not by 1099s. We also have an entirely different category of borrowers, and that is self-employed borrowers. And of all the groups, I think that is the most confusing about how income is counted, it has to be self-employed borrowers. We've been talking the whole time about statutory employees. We can count 100% of their gross pay. When it comes to self-employed borrowers, it is not that number at all. Before we get to that, though, Carrie, how is a self-employed borrower defined? In other words, at what point are you considered to be self-employed rather than just an employee?
Well, it would be someone who either files a Schedule C on your regular 1040 or you own 25% or more of your business.
And owning 25% or more of your business, does it matter whether that business is a corporation or a partnership or an LLC or an LLP?
Nope, it's all the same.
So no matter what the structure of your company is, even whether that's a Schedule C or not, usually a Schedule C is a sole proprietor, so you own 100% of the business. But when it comes to the other forms of companies, it really does not matter what form your company is. It matters what percent of that company do you actually own. If it's 25% or more, you are by definition self-employed. Now, many self-employed borrowers will pay themselves W-2 wages out of their own corporation, for instance. If you have a sub-S corporation, you can pay yourself W-2 wages. So how does the lender count W-2 wages for a self-employed borrower?
They will count 100% of the W-2 wages.
They will indeed do that. So you do not lose the money because you paid it out through your own corporation. It is counted as part of your income. However, there can be another factor that can either enhance that income or potentially can take away from that income. And that is a self-employed borrower, as far as their income is concerned, is treated in the manner of what is the net profit of the corporation itself or the LLC or the partnership or the sole proprietorship. However it is not gross receipts. And this is very common. We'll ask a self-employed borrower, what was your income last year? And they said, well, I made $2 million. Well, they didn't really make $2 million. They had $2 million in revenues for their company. But when it comes down to it, they actually could have reported a loss, even reporting $2 million in net receipts, in gross receipts for the year from their business. So it is not your gross receipts as a self-employed borrower. It is your net income. Now, net income can be profit or loss. If it's profit, Carrie, how is the profit added to the borrower's W-2 income?
The percent of the profit or loss that belongs to the borrower will be credited and added to the W-2.
Okay, so if a borrower, for instance, owns 50% of a corporation and the corporation reported $100,000 profit, well, 50% of that belongs to the borrower, so $50,000 gets added to whatever W-2 wages that same corporation paid the borrower. On the other hand, if the corporation reported $100,000 loss, then 50% of that loss belongs to the borrower if they own 50% of the corporation, and that would actually be subtracted from the borrower's income. So being a self-employed borrower can be a two-edged sword. You get to benefit from any of the profit of the company, but you also suffer if there is a loss. Now, some losses within a corporation or a partnership or an LLC are just paper losses. They're not, I want to say real, they're not actual losses. There are losses that are the tax laws allow a corporation to take. For instance, one of those is depreciation. A corporation may have made an investment in machinery and equipment, may own vehicles, may own other fixed assets that the IRS allows for the corporation to write off as an expense based on how the lifetime of how long that asset will perform and last. So where we have depreciation write-offs and where we have depletion write-offs and sometimes what are known as accelerated depreciation write-offs like Section 179, we actually are allowed to add those deductions back to the corporation and count as additional income. So again, let's go back to our scenario where a borrower owns 50% of a corporation who has reported a $100,000 profit. Normally, we'd be crediting them with $50,000 additional income. But say the corporation had $100,000 in depreciation write-off. Well, that's another $50,000 of recoverable income that can be credited to the borrower. Maybe that same corporation had the $100,000 loss, and we have to count a $50,000 loss against the borrower. But hey, if there was a $100,000 depreciation write-off, then that's $50,000 depreciation that gets added back, and we don't effectively carry a loss over to the borrower. So self-employed borrowers, while they're kind of held hostage by their net income, there are some items that can be recaptured and be added back into the borrower's income stream. So W-2s are counted at 100%. Profit or loss is counted at their ownership percentage. We are allowed to recapture certain paper write-offs like depreciation and depletion allowances. There are also some things that can help a self-employed borrower as they are preparing to purchase a home or as they're preparing to refinance a home. And we sometimes butt heads a little bit with the CPAs over this, but many small business owners, when they take out a business credit card, they're required to personally guarantee that credit card. Or if they go down and buy a car for the company use, they have to sign on the dotted line as an individual responsible for that loan, even though the loan's going to be and the car's going to be in the name of the corporation. Now, one thing that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of the underwriting systems allow is where a third party is making a debt payment, and that debt shows up in the borrower's consumer credit file, as long as you can show that for the past 12 months, another party has made the payment, you don't have to count that payment in a borrower's debt ratio. And that can become very, very important in qualifying for a mortgage loan, because there's certain debt criteria that have to be met, and we can basically exclude debts that are paid by a third party. Well, a third party can be a borrower's corporation. So one of the things we often counsel our self-employed borrowers to do is if you are going to purchase a car that you're going to use for company purposes, and, you know, sometimes it's not all for company use, sometimes it's personal use. And when you get to do your corporate taxes, the CPA has to ask you how many miles did you use this for business purposes, and we're going to take this deduction. However, many times the CPAs will say make the car payment on your own and then charge the car to the corporation. Our recommendation would be the opposite. Let the company make the car payment and then adjust the mileage deduction afterwards at the end of the tax year to deduct the correct amount. And then the borrower has to take the rest as their own expense. The benefit of a corporation making a car payment is that that car payment doesn't have to be counted in the borrower's debt ratios.
And I want to add to that, the business also has to write off the car's interest. The underwriter has to be able to see that on the business tax returns exclude it.
That's right. It has to be a legitimate business expense. You can't just shuttle your personal debt over to your corporation and then deduct those payments. It has to be a legitimate business expense, and the tax returns have to reflect that when you look at the tax returns. So, Carrie, when we come to self-employed borrowers, we've got that rule again.
The two-year average.
The two-year rule. What do you think the reason is for the two-year rule? What are they really looking for? Why do we have to take, like with the self-employed borrowers, we can't just take their most recent year. We can't take the most recent months. We've got to go back 2 years, and we have to average the income that was reported on the last 2 years' tax returns. Why do you think they do that?
It's really just about continuity, because there's no guarantee what your business is going to do this coming year. So they have to show the pattern to come up with the average.
And so they consider that past performance is an indication of future anticipated income.
Mm-hmm.
If a business has performed well over the last 2 years, it's likely that it's going to perform well in the coming year. Now, after averaging that income, there can be some exceptions as to whether they will indeed use the average. Because what happens, Carrie, when, say, in 2016, a corporation had $100,000 profit, then in 2017, that figure dropped to $50,000.
Unfortunately, they will use the most recent lower year.
That's right. So a self-employed borrower is always in great shape if their net income is increasing year over year. You get to use the two-year average. However, if over the last 2 years there has been declining income, you don't get to average. You still have to show the 2 years, but you have to take the lower, the most recent figure, rather than averaging the income. And then there's a kind of a loan killer for a self-employed borrower, and that is if there has been declining income year over year over the last 2 years, and coupled with that, you provide a profit and loss statement for the current year that is even lower than the most recent year, then an underwriter can just turn the loan down at their own discretion, because there is no indication there that there is a healthy ongoing increase in revenue. In fact, there's an indication that the company may be going down. So one thing that self-employed borrowers have to do when they apply for a mortgage loan is not only provide the last 2 years of tax returns, they also have to provide a profit and loss statement from the most recent quarter or the most recent half year or wherever they might be in the tax year. If you were applying for a loan today and you were a self-employed borrower and you had not filed your 2017 taxes, then you'd have to give us your 2015 and 16 taxes and a 2017 profit and loss. Plus, we're a few months into 2018 now. We'd need a profit and loss for that, too. And the underwriter is going to look for continuing strong business activity. They are going to prefer increasing income and net profit. They can deal with a little bit of a decline, but if the decline is across the span of 3 years, then it's not likely that as a self-employed borrower, you're going to be qualified at all, no matter what your income is. When we get back, we're going to cover other types of income, alimony, child support, and other irregular income, as well as we'll cover 1099 income for independent contractors. See you back after the break.
Welcome back to the Mortgage Moment. I'm Carrie Deese here with Mark Wells. Don't forget you can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com or call us on Monday at 864-235-9596. And we're going to continue talking about the very clear and easy to explain topic of income.
Yeah, there's could be a whole book written on this subject. Let me make it really easy. Call us. We'll figure out your income for you. So there can be other kinds of income floating around out there, and we need to address some of those because we get these questions all the time. Alimony and child support, very common. Carrie, what are the conditions under which alimony and child support income can be credited to a borrower as part of their qualifying income?
Well, it has to be continuing for at least 3 years and will require a copy of the divorce decree and any addendums to show that. And that decree will show the dates in which the child support and alimony will end. And it should also show the ages of the children. Now, if your child is currently 15 and his or her birth date has already passed this year, we would not be able to use child support for that child unless the decree says that it will continue into college or something to that effect.
So there's again, the test of income is always past receipt and anticipated continuity. That continuity has to be at least 3 years. So if your child is 15, you would not continue to receive alimony after they turned 18 unless your divorce decree specifically allows for that. So you would not be able to count that portion of child support. You may have two or three children, and fortunately there are child support tables in South Carolina that will indicate when one child drops from the age requirement, what the remaining child support will be. We can count the remaining child support for the children who are not yet 15. Alimony requires at least a 3 more year continuation in order to count it. it is counted at its gross amount, as is child support. And technically, because child support is not taxed, we can even increase that by 25% above what you're receiving, credit you with that as income because it's not taxable. Alimony is taxable. Can't do it with that.
And another thing with that, you do have to have been receiving it for at least 6 months before your loan closes. And we do have to document with canceled checks or account transfers from both parties to show that you have been receiving that documentation. Unfortunately, the divorce decree alone is not enough.
And one question we get quite often is, can I count income that is being received through a current separation agreement? Unfortunately, until that matures to a divorce decree, income that is being received under a current settlement, a separation agreement, cannot be counted as income. So other types of income that borrowers may be receiving, pension income is a big one. How do we count pension income? Well, at 100% of your monthly amount, again, the gross amount, not net if they're taking anything out of that. However, again, the continuity must be there. So we have to show that the pension is either a life pension or that it's not a lifetime pension, that they will receive it for at least 3 more years to count it. We often get questions about annuity income. And again, annuity income follows the same pattern. Have you been receiving it? Will you continue to receive it for the next 3 years? So annuity incomes can sometimes be lifetime annuities, but sometimes they can be periodic annuities. As long as they continue for the next 3 years, we can count your pension and your annuity income at 100% of what you're receiving and credit that to you. Dividend and interest income is always one that comes up. And sometimes people have significant retirement assets in IRAs. IRA income can be counted in a number of complex ways. Once you turn 59 and a half and are able to withdraw from an IRA, we can take the balance in your IRA, divide it by 20 years, and credit you with a monthly income from a 20-year stream from a current IRA without your having to actually begin to withdraw the funds. So you could have a substantial IRA. We can credit you with income from that even if you're not drawing the income. If you are 59 and a half years old and are not even drawing it. Once you reach the mandatory withdrawal age, then you can be credited with the IRS minimum required withdrawal as income. And that terms itself out according to the IRS tables, and we can count that kind of income for you at that time. Dividend and interest income, it has to be reported on your tax return, so this would not be interest earned in an IRA or another retirement vehicle, but would simply be interest earned from savings. That is subject to the two-year rule. You average the last 2 years receipt of dividend and interest income. It also has to have the continuity test. So we have to have the asset statements showing enough funds that that amount of interest and dividend income would be expected to continue in order to count that too. Always the test for qualifying income, past receipt and expected continuity. The two-year rule inserts itself into almost every situation we have. Continuity is considered to be at least for 3 more years when we're talking about continuity. So, Kerry, there are probably some other types of income I haven't been thinking of. What else do we need to cover?
Social Security income and disability income. And with those, as long as no taxes are coming out, depending on the loan program, we can do what is called grossing up. So we can increase it by either 15% or 25%, depending on the loan program. And that's just to kind of put it on par with taking gross taxable income.
That's right. So if you're receiving $1,000 in Social Security income, if you're doing an FHA loan, we can actually credit you with $1,150 of income. We've grossed it up 15%. If you're doing a conventional loan, we can gross that up to $1,250. Again, the underwriting rules allow for that because in other instances where they've taken your income into account, they've already taken the taxable portion into account. And with Social Security, we get to increase that as part of your qualifying income. Well, I think we've covered a bunch of income scenarios. We're happy to look at your individual income scenario. So feel free to email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com or call us at 864-235-9596, and we'll get your qualifying income down to the penny for you. Before we leave the topic, we need to talk about 1099 income. This is something that we're seeing on an increasing basis. I remember in the early 90s, we just never had anyone come in with a 1099. They came in with a W-2, or they came in self-employed, and we just didn't see that type of income. So, Carrie, share with our audience, what is 1099 income and how is it treated?
1099 income is when you are an independent contractor and a company pays you. It looks just like a W-2, but no taxes are coming out. So you'll file that as a sole proprietor on a Schedule C, and you'll pay your taxes that way.
And typically that is where we see it filed, and that may be an easy way for most borrowers to determine, so how am I treated? Now, if you report 1099 income on a Schedule C, you are also allowed to take certain deductions, business expense deductions. And again, that can be your enemy when you come to get a mortgage loan. It can be your friend when you're paying the tax man, because it diminishes the amount of money you have to pay taxes on. But then when you come to get a mortgage loan, it can hurt you, because the lender, remember, for a self-employed borrower, and if you file Schedule C, you're self-employed, they are going to count your net income. So if you deduct, for instance, your automobile expenses in getting to and from your job, and if you deduct meals and entertainment expenses, all of these can take away from your qualifying income, leave you with less income than you think when you're ready to buy a house or refinance a house.
And meals and entertainment is especially tricky, because in addition to it being backed out to get to your net income, they will also subtract an additional 50% of that from your net income figure.
I think some of this, if nothing else, shows the complexity of income calculations. We go from a very straightforward W-2 wage earner who doesn't have any overtime, doesn't have any bonus, doesn't have any commission. That's pretty easy. It's just the gross amount on the paycheck that's credited. But in all of these other income scenarios, you can begin to understand how it's not a very straightforward question to ask, do I have enough income to qualify for this house? There's quite a process in determining which income can be counted, what percent of that income can be counted, where deductions have to occur, where additions can be made, where income can be used at its face value, or where it can be grossed up and increased. We have covered a lot of ground here, and I leave it to our audience out there. Again, if you have any particular situation that you have questions about, we are happy to provide answers. Did have a guy who came in a few weeks ago with tax returns. He owned like five corporations, and some of those corporations own parts of the other corporations. And we see those extremes too, but we can help all of you with determining where your qualifying income is, where your borrowing capacity is. With Mark Wells and Carrie Deese, The Mortgage Moment. Thanks for tuning in. Been talking about qualifying income. Why does that even matter? What is it? And the reason we have to determine qualifying income is because of the single biggest question we get, and that is, how much house can I afford? Probably every borrower who is out there ready to house hunt has that question. How much house can I buy? The question of affordability, well, it has to do with how much income you're making. That's your qualifying income. But it also has to do with how much debt you're carrying. So as we look at the question, how much house can I afford, there are a couple of guidelines that allow us to compute how much house you can buy. and how much house you can afford. Those underwriting guidelines are called debt ratios. Debt ratios are basically the percent of your qualifying income that is going to take to make your house payment, as well as the percent of your qualifying income that is going to take to service all of your household debt and all of your household obligations once you buy the house. We use the qualifying income, the type of income that we've talked about in the earlier part of the show, to determine your income. But your debt can be determined by things that are obvious, but maybe by some things that aren't quite so obvious either. Where did they come up with debt ratio guidelines? Well, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, all of the different lending programs have tracked mortgage statistics for over 70 years, and they know exactly what the default rate is going to average over time. A default rate is how many loans go into a foreclosure situation where someone is no longer able to make their house payment. Now, despite what you might think about big bad banks, the last thing in the world a bank wants to own is a house. They don't want your house back. They want you to continue to make your house payment. So they don't want to get you into a situation where you're buying too much house and one day something's going to come up that trips you up. All of a sudden you can't make your house payment and they've got to foreclose on you. They do not want that situation. So debt ratios have been developed in a statistical manner to make sure that the borrower, apart from a catastrophic event outside of their control, is going to be able to sustain their house payment and their debt payments indefinitely without ever getting into trouble. Now, some people get into trouble even when their ratios are where they should be, but the statistics show that if you manage your household debt and your home debt in an appropriate manner, and you make the right lifestyle choices, you'll be able to sustain that over the 30-year life of the loan that you're taking out, or the 15-year life, or whatever you choose. So there are two debt ratios. Carrie, what are the ratios that a lender looks at in determining affordability?
There's the house ratio, which is just the house payment against your total income. And there's your total debt ratio, which is all of your debt against your income.
Okay, so for instance, if you're a borrower and let's say you're making $60,000 a year, the house ratio is the percent of that $60,000 is going to take to make your house payment each year. Or if you take it down to a monthly income, $60,000 income is $5,000 a month. Your house ratio is the percent of $5,000 that it takes to make your house payment. What does the lenders allow for that, Carrie? How much of your qualifying income can go towards making your house payment?
And this is not a hard and fast figure, but typically about 28%.
That's a good rule of thumb. If you're doing some rough calculations, you might could say a third. That's 33%. So you'd be a little bit high. But about 28 to 30% of your gross income, if you're a W-2 statutory employee, or 28 to 30% of your net income, if you're a self-employed borrower, can go towards your house payment. What do they count as your house payment, Carrie?
The total principal, interest, taxes, insurance, and homeowners association dues.
Ah, that little homeowners association dues. Got to watch that one.
That's
kicked us a number of times because it used to be just condominiums had HOA dues, but now townhouses do, many subdivisions do, just for the upkeep of common areas. And particularly with the more Central Park-like developments going on, the HOA dues can be substantial even when you own a single-family residence in one of those subdivisions. So your house payment includes, as Carrie said, the loan itself, the payment on the loan itself, but also your monthly amount for your taxes, property taxes, your monthly amount for your homeowner's insurance, and any HOA dues that you might have to pay to a homeowner's association.
And they calculate the taxes and insurance into those debts regardless of whether you choose to escrow.
That's still part of the debt. Yeah, whether you do not, some people choose not to escrow if they can, but we still have to count what their taxes and insurance are in their housing ratio. Now, there's a second ratio, and it's a total debt ratio, and you derive your total debt ratio by taking the house payment plus all other consumer debt payments. These commonly include automobile payments, credit card payments, student loan payments, any consumer debt that you have signed for and are responsible for. And there again, there's some things that can jump up and bite you. We'll talk about co-signing for a child on a credit card or a car, how that can affect your borrowing capacity at a house. But Kerry, on total debt ratio, what are the limitations usually on most programs?
And again, it's not a hard and fast figure, but they like to see around 41%. A lot of times you might be able to go up to 45, and if it's, or 44.99, and if it's a conventional, you might even be able to go up to 49.99 as long as the other facets of your loan are strong.
So we talk about underwriting guidelines. And we call them guidelines sometimes rather than rules because there is some degree of flexibility. Kerry, would you say that most people are limited by their house ratio or by their total debt ratio and what how much house they can afford?
It's usually the total debt ratio where we run into issues.
And this is, you know, an American problem, I think. We tend to carry a good bit of household debt. We usually have car loans. We certainly have credit card loans, revolving debt, which we probably use too much of. And when people come in and sit down with us and say, how much home can I buy? Sometimes they're severely disappointed because it's not the fact that they couldn't make the house payment. It's the fact that they can't make their total debt payments if they have a limiting factor. So the total debt ratio is often the barricade to the type of home ownership that someone might choose to be. So we do a lot of credit counseling and we do a lot of help in reassessing where other debt is. Kerry, I want to talk about student loans because that's become, if anything, is a modern plague. I think I see that one all the time. Student loans and student loan debt more and more are coming into play into affordability of housing for young borrowers, those who are just starting out. We have many borrowers whose student loan payments are deferred, so they don't have a payment. So, Kerry, does that mean we don't have to count that debt in their debt ratio?
In the past, we were able to completely exclude those payments if they were deferred for more than 12 months. But now we either have to count, we have to assign a payment and count either 1% of the balance as a monthly payment, or you have to get what the actual payment will be from the student loan servicer.
That's right. So we had an advantage for a few years of being able to exclude student debt ratio if it was deferred. But now, no matter what it is in deferment status, we have to assign 1% of balance. That means if you've got a $10,000 student loan, as far as a mortgage lender is concerned, you've got a $100 a month debt. And unfortunately, we see many young borrowers with not just $10,000 of student debt, but sometimes $40,000 and $50,000. That is the assigning of a $400 to $500 payment, and that can often be a limiting factor in the affordability of how much house you can afford. Now, Kerry, student loans are sometimes paid by parents. So what if we have a record of a student loan in which the parent has been making the payment on the student loan? How do we treat that?
As long as we can show that the parent has been making, and by show, I mean clearly document, the payment for the last 12 months, we can exclude it from the debt.
That's right. That's that third-party exclusion rule we talked about earlier, that if we can show that, and we have to show it by canceled checks. There's no other means of showing it. Have to clearly show that the parent was making the debt payment, then we can exclude it at that point from the borrower's debt ratio. So, hey, maybe this is a little bit of a planning thing. If you're a young borrower, you've got a lot of student loan debt that is deferred. And you know, there's some deferral programs that are set up, for instance, within the educational system. You can take all of your student loans, and if you're willing to work in a less developed part of the state will pay your student loans off after 10 or 15 years under their program. But unfortunately, we can't exclude that debt. But if you're planning on buying a house and you're not going to be making student loan payments in the future, as far as you can tell, you know, you may want to talk to mom and dad about making those payments for you. You can give them the $100 a month or whatever it is so that they can make the payment for you, but then you could exclude that debt when you get ready to buy a house. I'm going to mention real briefly the debt ratios. We've mentioned that the house ratio in most programs is about 28%. If you're not carrying much of any additional debt, you can actually run your home ratio on up into the upper 30s and even around 40%. So again, not carrying other debt can make a big difference in how much house you can buy. But most home ratios are about 28 to 30% of your monthly income. VA is kind of the only one that's really different. The loans made to veterans only generate one debt ratio, and that's a total ratio. They don't really care what portion is house and what portion is total debt. They only count a 41% total ratio.
And I want to sneak in there before we run out of time here, a couple of other things that we do have to count that sometimes sneak up on us. If you're paying child support, alimony, if you have a payment arrangement with the IRS or your state, we do have to count those monthly payments. And if you have any garnishments, we have to count those as well.
Thanks for that, Carrie. There's always, with all these guidelines, the nuances, the little rules that jump up and bite us. Best thing to do is to contact us. We can take a look at your entire situation. Call us at 864-235-9596. We can help you structure your debt to get ready to buy a house. We can help you wherever you are. This has been The Mortgage Moment, WGTK 94.5 The Answer. Thanks for joining us.